Final hour, Robbie and Rex Road, 102.5, 106.3, The Game. Robbie Stanley, Joe Rex Road, Nick Keyser here with you on this Thursday morning. And we go to our 102.5 The Game phone line, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com. Welcome in our friend Charles Robinson from Yahoo Sports. Charles, good morning. Where are we today? How's life right now?
Oh, I'm home.
Oh, boy.
I threw in the towel at 18. I was like, I'm done. I'm going home after this. So.
Did you remember where you lived?
Yeah, I did. I was the locks were changed, but you know, I had money to get a locksmith, and there was no problem. The dogs wanted me inside; that was enough. So,
did Dawn hear my little ding when I texted you topics?
No, she's upstairs right now. Okay. I don't think. She hasn't come downstairs right now. I'm sure you'll hear the dogs at some point. Probably run downstairs because as soon as they hear me talking, they freak out and want to be a part of the show. So.
Hey, we're all for it.
Yeah, they're welcome.
I heard you guys were ranting about Retold. I call it Retold.
Yes.
That is a great call. Yeah. Like, just very like, okay, great. Thanks for recapping stuff that's already been told.
Hey, Netflix needs content, clearly.
I
was like, we could do this. We could talk to some people and get some good, you know, some eye candy footage and just kind of rehash things that have already been. They lost me on Swamp King, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Like, that was it for me. I was like, this is the, you know, these new quote unquote documentaries that allow you to retell your past. As Joe likes to tell the story about the Michigan State football game where he broke his finger and or rib or whatever it was. Yeah,
Charles is not there that day. Well, you know,
playing hurt.
In case you didn't know, that was the alumni game, and we kicked their butt. So we redeemed our college failures when I was smoking cigarettes and leading touchdown drives.
Yeah,
Charles is a good center.
I'm sure.
Went to the center.
Anyway, I don't know. How would you even remember that? I don't know. I have no, when you brought it up, I was like, where was I?
It was only a quarter century ago, dude. Come on.
Yeah. Every time you bring it up, I'm like, where was I? How come I wasn't?
You were there. Yeah. I have pictures of you running around in your State News jersey. So I know you were there, dude.
Nice. Well, that's fine.
Not the alumni game, I don't think.
No. Not the alumni game. No.
No.
That's what I'm telling you.
I did. I was at one. Yeah.
Uncle Rico over here just chucking the football around. So Charles,
I was dating a photographer on our staff at the time, so I was trying to impress her. That's probably why I'm playing in the game.
Yep. So Charles, I want to start with you on this because we're going to talk about it here in a few minutes. But you know, Colts Bengals joint practice, a lot of chirping at Anthony Richardson going on, and Bengals defenders talking about how he can only throw to a spot and asking the question if he's ever going to throw the football or if all he does is put the ball down and run. What do you think of the Anthony Richardson situation heading into this year? Is there a concern that maybe he's further behind than people think heading into the season? How do you view the Richardson part of this?
No, I didn't get there, and I'm disappointed about that because I that is one of those spots that I'm fascinated by where this is going because the snapshot was so limited on Richardson. It's fascinating to me that in the lead up to the draft, we had all this consternation and we're like, you know, he's going to take all this time to develop as a passer and he's so raw. And the college experience was so limited. He comes to the NFL, he plays, you know, parts of four games. And then that completely, everybody just decides that, okay, wow, great pick. He's like an MVP candidate, dark horse MVP candidate coming into this year and all these different things. And I'm like, you know, no one's bringing up like, you know, at no point is anyone like, well, what if it's RG3? What if it's there have been other quarterbacks who have come in and looked brilliant. And then, you know, there's injuries or the league catches up and it changes things. And I think people are giving the Josh Allen experience way too much credence in this situation where they're like, well, Josh Allen was so uniquely gifted as an athlete and his arm was great and his mobility was great and athleticism and he caught up to the game. It took him 3 years. Like, and it was a rough ride at times. And he played games. He played seasons. He was healthy. And so to me, when we look at Richardson, I have no idea what he's going to look like when, and you know, you bring up, Robbie, you bring up what they're saying in practice. I mean, that's what they're hearing, by the way, in their defensive meetings. You know, that's what, whatever the limited tape is, they're going to say, well, he likes to run this way. Like, you know, he only likes to go left or right, or he only likes to throw to a spot, or he stares someone down. You know, he's a one-read, you know, a one-read quarterback, can't ever get off his first read. And if he can't get off his first read, he starts to try to create after that, and that gets him into trouble with injuries because then he takes punishment. These are all things that, you know, defenders hear in their meetings. And so I think right now with Richardson, people are just betting heavy on a limited snapshot of someone who looked fun, and clearly all the gifts are there or were there that we expected, but yet we don't know how he's going to respond to a pretty significant, you know, injury and another layoff and a lack of football for a long period of time. And then once he starts to get rolling, what his tendencies are and whether or not he can even adjust. I don't think there's no way anybody can look at him and say, yeah, he can adjust. He can adjust the tendencies. He can react once he's solved and grow and become a different player who can challenge defenses or manipulate them. But I don't think we know any of that right now. All we know is the same things we knew going into the draft, is that, you know, he brings a ton to the table athletically. And now we know that he's, I would say it's fair to say he is a very large injury risk, given the fact that he did nothing but expose himself repeatedly as a rookie. And I still don't know whether he's learned not to do that.
Yeah, it's, I got to say, like, even some of the stuff, like apparently the Bengals players were like, my God, please give us a challenge. You know, and then Joey Brad is like, geez, is it that bad? But that's, well, it's going to be really interesting.
I will say this in his defense, because, okay, so I'm in Cleveland's practice, right? And I'm watching joints against the Vikings, and I think they were in like 7-on-7 or 11-on-11 red zone. And I'm watching Deshaun Watson. He does not look good. I'm like, oh, my God, like, this looks rough. And he's, you know, the Vikings are jumping every route. He threw a pick six. Like, it was rough. But as I'm watching it, I'm going, this is like every single call is a Pop Warner call right now. There's nothing complicated about what they're throwing at Minnesota's defense. The advantage is 100% on the defensive side. They're in a tight space. And basically it is, you know, one decision and go. And every defender is just sitting there going, all I got to do is just read the guy's eyes and jump it. He's not going to have time. Because, you know, if you hold it too long, it's a sack, right? That's what you hear in practice. Sack, yep. Sack, sack. And so I sat there and I'm like, this is not going to come off good. He's going to, you know, somebody's going to come out of here saying how bad he looks. And realistically, what is he geared with in this practice to make him look good in this situation? It's not much. And that's what happened. I left and I saw some people saying, you know, on social media and like other people who had been watching, who are on our side of the fence in the profession, who were like, you know, Watson looked terrible. And I just don't think in a situation like that, they were putting him in any kind of a scenario where they're going to expose anything to a defense. And I think you know, in these joint practices, that happens a lot to the quarterbacks. They're running such obvious stuff that the quarterbacks are often at a detriment in these situations. And I would argue that's why the exhibitions are still somewhat, valuable, because at least it opens the field a little bit more. I think it can be a little more challenging in exhibition games than it is on defense in some of these joint practices. So I guess that's the one thing I would say about him is, you know, it's one thing for the defense to be chirping in that situation. It's another thing when it's a wide open 100-yard field and it's sideline to sideline and, you know, maybe you're getting something a little less vanilla, not much less, but I'd be careful about how much we put into what the joint practices are. I mean, they're great, they're valuable, but you have to know exactly where the value is. And I don't think running, quote unquote, running your stuff and giving your quarterback the best opportunity to look great is realistic.
What's this spying on QBs? They're spying. Who's spying on? Yeah. Who's spying on what QBs, yeah. Charles?
So I'm going back and I'm like, you know, at the end of the trip, you're like, all right, well, I did all these notebooks, but what didn't I use? Like, what? Because you end up talking to coaches and GMs in much more broad terms about just different things going on in the NFL. And one of the things, as I like kind of went back and started to look through all my notes, I had a number of conversations with whether it was GMs and or coaches, it was about, you know, the rookie quarterbacks and sort of the evaluation process. And I think it's funny, they won't, I don't think guys are really going to admit it publicly. Maybe the closest that it really came was the Top Golf event at the Chargers, where they brought all the rookies in together, the rookie quarterbacks. And then they basically admitted, I don't know if they even admitted it publicly, but it was written about quite a bit, that this whole event was basically just to watch these guys together, like all the alphas together, to see actually how the alphas interacted, who did what. And they really, when I went through Chargers camp, it was interesting talking to people there, because they really did. Like, they had almost anybody who was at the event could give you notes on how each individual quarterback reacted, who they were talking to, who they kind of sidled up to, how often they were on their phones. I almost wondered, like, was everybody in the organization on this trip watching these guys? Like, was that their assignment? I think it might have been. And I was talking to another GM, and he said to me, he was talking about looking at the rookie quarterbacks, and he admitted to me, he was like, you know, at the combine, he said something along the lines of, like, I kind of felt weird because I was always in, like, these corners watching these guys, like literally spying on them, just trying to, in every chance I got, to see them talking to different people in different situations and scenarios. And, like, what he described was kind of creepy. And, but he said, like, this is the part of our model that is so difficult now with quarterbacks, is we don't, there are analytics for it. We don't know how to model that into our evaluations of quarterbacks in terms of their personality. So the only way you can really do it is having them in and viewing them for a day, but then kind of following them around everywhere whenever you're in a common place, hiding and, like, watching them just to see how they react in scenarios where they think you might not be watching them. And I remember years ago when Jameis Winston was the number one pick, I think it was the Buccaneers, might not have been the Buccaneers, some team put a plant on a plane with Jameis when he was flying in to visit them. So they put somebody on the plane to watch Jameis on a just a commercial airline flight to see how he interacted,
good
who
Lord.
He talked to, how he treated the attendants, things like that. I think that's, it's just, it's interesting to me that this is clearly something that teams are still having, for all the data and everything they bring to the table now, what they're still struggling to understand is how these guys operate when no one's watching. So they're trying to find opportunities that they can either create or discover where these players are like, okay, finally, I can let my guard down. I don't have to be the pre-programmed robot that the agent, you know, has sent off into the world. I can just be who I am. And they're trying to figure out, you know, what that ultimately says about the players. So
Charles,
I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Charles, Tua ripped Brian Flores earlier this week with Dan Le Batard, and it brought up an interesting discussion with us. I mean, we talked to you at the time about the Tua Flores stuff and everything that went down there. But
yeah,
in general, at large, do you think the days of the old school defensive style head coach, are they dying in the NFL, or is that an overreaction and we're kind of in a cyclical phase where everybody wants the new up and coming guy that can connect with the quarterback now as head coach of their team? How do you view kind of the style of coaching that we're seeing in the league now, what this could mean for some of the old school guys?
I don't think it's dying. I think, you know, you look at Mike McDonald coming out of Baltimore and going into the NFC West, and nobody in the NFC West is happy about that. Like, everybody, like the other teams in, they all are like, oh, great. Like, this is the guy who's coming. They know his reputation. They know what he's done defensively as a, you know, play caller and a schemer in Baltimore. And, you know, so I think the respect, and remember, you know, and Jonathan Gannon obviously is there with Arizona, but Kyle Shanahan and Sean McVay in particular are two coaches who weren't, like, really thrilled to see that guy roll into the division. And so I think when you see the minds that you respect offensively talk about a defensive coach like that, I think we are in a rotation right here. I do think there's a cyclical reaction. I don't know, given where money is going financially in the NFL, it will ever turn over completely into, like, some big wave of defensive coaches. Because teams are always, given what quarterbacks make now, they're always going to think there's going to be a heavy priority of like, how can we maintain consistency in the life of our quarterback once we pay him $50 million plus, you know, moving forward. So that will always put a premium, I think, on offensive coach. Now, that said, I can tell you Zach Orr in Baltimore is a coach that I think is drawing a lot of curiosity. He's 32 years old, just turned 32 in June. He's going to be running their defense now. I think people are like, let's see what this is. I mean, great player who injuries ended his career early there. And, you know, but I think he's kind of that up-and-comer that you are already kind of hearing things about with teams eyeing him to see, could he be sort of that next defensive guy in the rotation who becomes the coach we have who can solve, you know, the offensive minds that we face consistently. I don't know, again, though, just because of how money is divided up with teams and quarterbacks, there will always be a premium on potentially having an offensive head coach, especially if he's a really good play caller who can come in and you know, ride through whatever, a decade plus with a quarterback contract. But yeah, I don't think we're not completely out of the league still being cyclical. I'm telling you right now, the wide receiver money, I just don't see that not eventually being cyclical in some sense, you know, because you can see, I definitely, the frustration is palpable when you get out there amongst teams that are like, if they're not complaining about how shocked they are at the top end money, they're complaining about like, okay, now the secondary money in terms of number one wide receivers is automatically $25 million plus. And like, you will talk, like, there are people that if I told you their names, you'd be like, wow, these are the people making the statements who are like, yeah, no way, never paying that money. I can find receivers. This is dumb. Like, this is not where the value is in the NFL anymore. And like, one huge name in the league was like, they better walk on water. Like, he was just straight up like, if they don't walk on water, I'm not paying a guy $25 to $35 million to be a wide receiver. I'll go to the draft and I can get wide receivers. You know, I can figure it out. That's not where the special is. So you see even a situation like that where you're like, how is this cycling? Coaches are the same. I think in some ways how players get paid are the same. It'll turn, and you'll see more opportunities, I think, for defensive coach.
Well, on that particular topic, you know, Flores and Tua, what did you think of what both of them said? No, that's fine. No, Robbie asked a general question, but I'm just wondering what your thought was on that, on the two different. I mean, I feel like Tua is probably getting more crap out of this, seems like, from what I'm hearing from people.
But. Yeah, well, I mean, there's the old school mentality is to be like, geez, how soft are you? Right. Like, really, like, you're that beat up about, you know, like, about this situation that you know, oh, he told you. I will say that it was prevalent enough, and we talked about this. When the Deshaun Watson thing was happening, I told everybody who would listen, like, this is so Flores-driven. There's a reason why they're involved in this, and is 100% Brian Flores. And I felt like no one would believe that. And the fundamental pursuit was being it was rooted at the time in Flores not believing in Tua as a starting quarterback, period. Now, I didn't know to what level he was verbalizing it. I mean, Tua made him sound like he's a bad guy. Like, he just straight up a bad guy. And, you know, that's pretty significant for a player, particularly that stature, to come out and just straight up say, hey, like, he essentially – to me, when I listen to it, I'm like, yeah, he's pretty much saying this guy tried to assassinate his career. Like that's what the level of disbelief was in him. You know, I think with Flores coming out and not walking it back was interesting, you know, and to me lends a lot of credence to what Tua is saying. And I think it did probably shake up Flores a little bit. But my big takeaway was, here's another ex-Bill Belichick coach trying to do things Bill Belichick does, but not doing them as well as Bill Belichick, and, you know, like, failing in a way fundamentally to be, you know, Josh McDaniels was guilty of it. Charlie Weiss was guilty of it. You know, in some sense, Romeo Crennel was. There's a lot of assistants that have come out there and been guilty of not being able to replicate some of the things that Belichick ultimately does. And, you know, I think the one thing I would say, too, beyond just them trying to replicate Belichick is,
Did we lose Charles?
I think we lost Charles.
Sorry about that. Oh. Fat cheeked it again. in terms of handling players with kid gloves, I will say this, it's not new. Okay. The coaches have been thinking about this for a long time. And, you know, Bill Walsh, I don't know if I've ever brought this book up, the Finding the Winning Edge book by Bill Walsh. That's like considered by Belichick, every coach you talk to, about one of the greatest franchise building models. It's a book that literally tells you, here's how to build a franchise. Here's how to deal with every decision inside the franchise. Awesome blueprint, right? In that book, Walsh says at one point, he talks about criticizing players. And he says something along the lines of, you have to know who you can criticize directly or can't, and you have to figure out a way to get to that person in the right way. And he brought up sometimes going to an assistant, whether it's an OC or a position coach, and saying, here, I'm going to call you out. I'm not calling this player out. I'm going to call you out in a meeting. I'm going to embarrass you, basically, in front of the team. And I want you to know it's not about you. I'm doing it because I want to get to that player. But I can't do it directly. I have to come in an angle that they're going to be able to absorb, that's not going to mess them up. And so they kind of cut a deal. And Walsh would go after an assistant, and then in Walsh's mind, some players would then rise to the occasion and go, man, my assistant's getting chewed out because of me. I did something. This is like I have to take ownership in this situation here. And I thought that was interesting. This is, and remember, this is going back decades, you know, 20, 30 years where Walsh is talking about this. I don't think anything's changed. I don't think it's a Gen Z thing or whatever. I think that football players have always been somewhat temperamental when it comes to criticism. I would say this is fairly outlandish in maybe the level of criticism, but don't just dump it on Tua and go, oh, he's just soft. I mean, honestly, a lot of players have not reacted well to much milder criticism than what Tua probably dealt with inside the Dolphins.
All right, Charles, last thing for you, and I just – there's a random question has come to mind that I'm interested to get your thoughts on. Number one, 1 to 10, your interest level in Tom Brady's first broadcast coming up on Fox here in a couple weeks. And number two, how good do you think he's going to be in that role after signing a 10-year, $375 million contract?
So I'm covering it. That's oh, nice. I'm definitely, yeah. That's like literally covering a game to simply focus in on how does Tom do this. I'm very interested. I think everyone's interested. And I think the bridge he has to cross, and people have discussed this before, but I think it's absolutely the number one priority, or should be the number one priority for him, is the ability to actually criticize the players that you're watching. You know, he's been critical so far in the comments that he's brought out. I talked to him at one point about the quarterback position, and I thought he was going to tell me, here's where the position is projecting out. It's in a great spot. No, he went the opposite and just ripped, you know, and he's done this now multiple times where he just rips how quarterback is being developed. And that's great, but give me a specific example. Say a name. That's my thing. And I think in broadcasting, you always walk that fine line because you go into production meetings midweek. You always ask for the quarterback, right? You sit there and you have great conversations with the quarterback. And what happens is you get onto the broadcast and you're afraid to go to basically rip it. When a quarterback plays horribly and they're making terrible decisions, a lot of broadcasters just couch it. They'll say, I'm not going to rip the guy directly. I'm not going to be, you know, I'm going to be very careful about how critical I am. I want to see if Brady can do that. And I think the thing I love about the Manning cast so much is that Peyton can't stop himself. Like when you watch it live, I'm like, he gives it all away. Even if he doesn't say it, his face verbalizes,
yeah.
You know, like
his hands on his head. Yeah.
100%. If he's disgusted in a quarterback, he will tell you. And at times he will say it verbally, but he will always say it emotionally. He will always say it in a reactionary way. And you know, it's a more difficult situation for Brady, I think, because it's a more traditional setup. You know, it's not just a camera on you, and it's not just, hey, grip it and rip it, do your thing. He's got to analyze, but also bring to the table direct criticism of players. I think that's what sets you apart and makes you great. Romo, to me, the diagnosing plays and telling us what's coming, that was all awesome. That was great stuff. But I think when Romo's at his best, it's when he'll get in the kitchen of a specific player and tell you exactly what a player did that he thinks is, like, you know, failing or succeeding or whatever. And it's a lot harder, I think, for people to do that nowadays with social media, because, you know, the second I rip a guy directly by name, it's going to be cut up and rebroadcast a million times, and Robbie and Joe and Charles are going to be talking about it on Thursday mornings. So,
yeah,
but that's what I'm interested in seeing. So, I've already heard complaints about his squeaky voice on you know, just sort of how he sounds on broadcast. That'll be fun too.
It will be. I'm sure, Joe will enjoy it too. Noted Brady hater, Joe Rexroth.
I'm not a Brady hater. Okay. I'm here for this. I'm rooting for him.
All right,
Charles.
You're rooting for him?
Sure.
Okay.
I'd like to see him do well. I don't want crappy broadcasts. He's going to be doing the best games. I don't want him to suck, right? This is for us, for all of
Joe's
us.
Joe's level of, like, rooting for individuals is a sliding scale.
Yeah, it is. Yes, it is. Charles, great stuff as always, man. Thanks for being with us, and we'll talk next week.
All right, appreciate it, guys. Have a good morning.
Charles Robinson from Yahoo Sports, our guest on Robbie and Rex. We'll react to what Charles had to say there. I do want to get into this Anthony Richardson stuff, because some pretty interesting comments coming out of Colts camp. We'll get into that. Mm-hmm. Robbie and Rex Road, 102.5, 106.3, The Game.